This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With newspaper circulation for years on the decline and local reporting in many areas all but disappeared, it's nothing new to hear that American media is troubled. The transition to a digital and mobile world has brought improvements to the speed of reporting and access to it, but it's also been rocky, with low digital ad revenues, increasingly polarized news sources, and social media echo chambers. And while these trends are present even on the quietest of news days, they become even more noteworthy during a tumultuous election cycle like this year, with a huge field of candidates and high stakes around the economy and foreign policy, with many looking to the media more than ever for information. Today in The Exchange, media and the 2016 election cycle. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests with us in studio. Meg Heckman, a lecturer teaching journalism at UNH, former reporter for the Concord Monitor and other publications. She's also currently writing for the Boston Globe. And Meg, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Also with us, John Tabor, publisher and president of Seacoast Media Group, which publishes five weekly newspapers and two dailies, the Portsmouth Herald and Foster's Daily Democrat. And John Tabor, thank you for coming in. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
And joining us from Massachusetts, Dan Kennedy, media critic and associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University, specializing in digital media and alternative business models for news. Dan is currently a Joan Shorenstein Center Fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And Dan Kennedy, great to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll start with you, Meg, but want to hear from everybody. You know, we've been hearing for a while now, at least the last decade or two, about the decline of traditional news media, starting with newspapers, reverberating outward. What do you think, Meg? How have these trends affected media coverage of this election, 2016?
Well, it's been a really mixed bag. The primary has long been a venue for innovation around the practice of journalism here in New Hampshire. And that dates back to the mid-1990s even, when you saw some small local newspapers band together to create this digital subscription service around the, I think it was the 96 primary. Some of it worked, some of it didn't work. And you've seen that continue to happen with each election cycle. And in some cases, it's been to counter losses in staffing and resources. And in other cases, it has been to try and stake a claim on owning political coverage here in New Hampshire.
That's really interesting. So the New Hampshire primary itself has been sort of a laboratory for media innovation.
Yeah, laboratory is exactly the right word. And that innovation brings with it good and bad. And I think we're seeing a really, really intense version of that this time around, because publishing technology has just gotten so cheap and so simple and so ubiquitous. And I don't know what it's going to look like when we kind of start to take stock on Wednesday morning, or, well, maybe not Wednesday, we'll all be exhausted, but next week when we start taking stock at what worked and what didn't work.
What do you think about that, Dan Kennedy? Real interesting that this election and especially the New Hampshire primary are laboratories for innovation in media.
Well, you know, I follow this pretty closely, and I think that probably the biggest problem that we have with the shrinkage of traditional journalism is in coverage of local communities. There is no shortage of political coverage. From where I'm sitting, it appears to be more than there's ever been. Some of the big New Hampshire papers, like the Union Leader and the Concord Monitor, may have less influence than they used to, but we've seen the rise of a tremendous number of new outlets, from Politico to the Huffington Post to BuzzFeed. They're all up there. Frankly, I think that we've always had more than enough coverage of the New Hampshire primary, and now we're getting more than we ever did before. So although I'm very concerned about what has happened to traditional journalism and what that means for communities, my concern really does not extend to political coverage. I think that the quantity is as great as it's ever been. The quality is another story, but maybe we'll get to that.
Absolutely. So, Dan, are you saying that there's a plethora of sources of national news, especially national political news? Your big concern is more, you know, on the ground covering the school board or the mayoral election.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's where we have problems because, you know, regional and local papers are just not doing nearly as well as they used to when they've had to cut back considerably on their mandate. I think this is especially true with accountability journalism at the local level, that there is a real lack. And I think actually one of the problems with journalism as the business of it is shrinking is that everyone wants to go chasing after the shiny object, which is why, as I say, there is absolutely no shortage of coverage of things like the New Hampshire primary. I would rather see some of these reporters pulled off the primary and sent to cover stories that nobody else is telling.
Well, and as we talk about local journalism, good thing you're here, John Tabor, again, publisher and president of Seacoast Media Group. What's your perspective on this?
Well, I think it's true that the print media is a mature business, a declining business, and that means it's consolidating. But let's remember that the daily papers across the state still have a large audience. If there's 500,000 or 600,000 voters today, probably a good half of those read the daily paper. And in fact, they're more engaged now. And this is always a great challenge for all of our staffs. This is when our readers are really turning to us. So I think the print media are still very engaged and very relevant, and that comes through when it's time to do the endorsements. The candidates still go to all the local dailies and seek their endorsement, and it's a wonderful process for all of us. It's a privilege to have our board sit with the candidates and ask the questions that they might not have thought of and really probe and find out who they are. And those endorsements then get echoed out through sharing on Facebook or email. And it's a very important job for us to try and vet the candidates.
How do you think the candidates themselves have adapted, John, but I want to hear from everybody, have adapted to this, you know, sort of mobile media, everywhere, all the time environment, and yet at a time of, you know, declining local coverage, how do you see campaigns adapting to that? You hinted to it when you said they take our endorsements and they put them everywhere.
Yeah. And we've also seen the rise of, in this election cycle, candidates who fly into New Hampshire, hold big rallies, get lots of television coverage, national coverage, and fly out. And that's so contrary to the tradition of New Hampshire. And it'll be fascinating to see today how that works. I happen to think that when candidates do the hard work of town meetings and going to every corner of the state, it pays off for them. It did for Bill Clinton. It did for lots of others in the past.
John McCain,
absolutely. We watched his rallies start with a small number of cars in the parking lot, and then 2 months, 3 months later, they were overflowing.
I remember. What do you think, Meg? How do you see candidates sort of manipulating, using this new media environment?
Well, we're not the only ones as journalists with access to these amazing, inexpensive, everywhere publishing and communication tools. And so I've seen a fascinating rise in the last two primary cycles of candidates kind of running their own newsrooms, their own publishing houses, where they are on YouTube, they're on Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever else is coming out, and then just their ability to use technology to target messages at specific segments of voters is fascinating. I wrote a piece for The Globe late last year, I think, about this really, really high-tech targeting of advertising that was actually inspired by some of my students at UNH who said they were seeing ads for last year's Senate race on their Xbox game when they were playing Xbox.
Yes. So, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah.
Right.
So campaigns are using every digital communication tool at their disposal. And a lot of times that means they don't need us as much. And that's creating some really interesting challenges in and of itself. And I want to be clear, I am a big believer of horizontal communication. I think that the more voices in the ecosystem, the better and the stronger the civic communication is going to be. But at the same time, it creates a need for a slightly different type of political journalism, fact-checking and more vetting and verification of all the messages that are out there. And that gets to what Dan was saying about the challenges of just not having the resources or choosing to devote those resources to covering the same thing that everybody's covering.
So they don't need traditional media anymore as much as they used to, whether it's New Hampshire Public Radio or National Public Radio or the Boston Globe or the New York Times or Foster's Daily Democrat, they don't need it as much as they used to, Meg. They can just bypass it with their own message.
Exactly. Or there's that perception, at least.
Yeah. So, Dan, what's the upshot of all that in terms of, you know, here we are again in the midst of a big civic discourse on primary day?
Well, you know, I don't think the media have covered themselves with glory in this campaign at all. And if candidates are able to get around the media, I think that the media bear a lot of responsibility for that because of the way they have covered this. Despite the explosion of outlets, what do we get is a relentless focus on Donald Trump, on and on and on. He has been probably the most overcovered candidate I can think of in recent years. We get a continual focus on the horse race, who's up, who's down. We really don't get much in the way of any sense as to what sort of a president any of these candidates would make. And then finally, when Meg refers to the vetting of what candidates say, one of the real frustrations that I have is the rise of fact-checking in recent years and how inadequate it really is. I mean, these fact-checking projects tend to approach things with very little nuance, and often you see a candidate who takes a position that is based on, you know, sincerely held beliefs labeled as a lie by a fact-checking site. What I find interesting about that is that it's kind of a tradition in journalism that we don't call something a lie, even when it's transparently a lie. And yet the tradition of these fact-checking enterprises is that something has to be called true or a lie, regardless of whether it's a lie or not. So I think that's problematic, too. I mean, I just think it's a relentless simplification, oversimplification, over-reliance on polling. And I don't think the public's being well served by this.
So that's interesting on the fact-checking, Dan. Some people say this is great. It's an opportunity to really dig into, you know, these facts and numbers and statements that the candidates make. But you sound less impressed.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that it's promising. Certainly, it can be helpful to point out when a candidate is saying something that's just wrong. But I do think that there is a fundamental flaw with fact-checking, and that is Politicians really don't flat out lie to the extent that people think they do. And the rise of fact-checking sites that's continually labeling statements as lies, I think it's a mismatch. It's a mismatch. The amount of lying that's taking place, I think, is really greatly exaggerated.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at media and the 2016 election cycle. And let's hear from you. How do you think media coverage has been during this election cycle? And more broadly, what changes do you see in the news business here in New Hampshire? We'd love to hear from you this morning, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's some Facebook comments when we asked our Facebook listeners how media coverage has been during this election cycle. Jake says, atrocious. Media needs reform. Let's bring back Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow to life. Get rid of these pundits who offer nothing more than slanted opinions for the public to regurgitate. Mark agrees. He says, horrible. Way too much coverage of Trump sound bites and not enough of the issues. Thank you for those comments, Mark and Jake. Let's go to our listeners, and the next caller is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Good morning. First of all, I want to applaud what the first speaker said about I'm a part of the firm Outdoor Local Journalism, which covers Candia, Deerfield, Nottingham, and Northwood. And we've grown up because the big media outlets like Manchester, Concord, don't cover the small towns, and we do. In fact, we're spending more time, as we should, on the local election, the selectmen, the school board. And that's where we put our time and effort. And I also want to say thank you to the Seacoast Media, because they publish our print edition. So they're nice folks, too.
So you're going hyper-local, Steve.
That's exactly, because that's where it's really at. But I can also tell you, a loose association, but I got to add it, I just voted this morning in Nottingham, and the lines were phenomenal. So I think they said we were going to break a record, and I'm sure we are. And
all
people
right.
Voting.
Well, and Steve, last question for you, because this is real interesting. So you are picking up the slack where some of the papers have had to cut back on their very local coverage. How do you pay for it?
We do with advertising, and it's hard. We have to get a lot of people because we are online and in print. And we with membership and basically advertisement. So
okay.
If anyone is hearing me in those towns, please, this is a good place for you to get your word out.
Steve, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think of this, John Tabor?
You know, a large part of our business is printing other newspapers. And the amount of entrepreneurial startups would amaze everyone who says newspapers are dying. Our caller is a great example of that. We see people starting free weeklies. We see people like Mark Garang, who has started a free daily, and it's been very successful in Conway, New Hampshire, and it's now almost 20 years old. So it always amazes us that in spite of what everybody says, people like Steve want to get the news out. And they find a way to do it and build a business around it.
So for people who aren't as involved in the news business as all of us sitting here, so what you guys do, if I understand right, John, is not only do you have those big printing presses for your own two dailies and your five weeklies, but you rent those out to little operations like Steve's and make more money there.
Right. We're a publisher's printer. And that's a third of our business.
Wow. And is that working for you?
Yes. Yes. And as our industry's shrinking and consolidating, fewer people want to have their own press with all that expense. So it's actually been an area of growth for us through the consolidation of the business.
Well, and it's fascinating because people are still churning those, you know, weeklies out or monthlies out or whatever at a time when anybody can take their smartphone, you know, touch it and have access to a ton of news. Whether you think it's good quality or not is up to you. But
and I think Dan and Meg would agree. Nobody has quite found the pure online way to do a local news source that makes money.
Disagree.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm going to go to you after a short break, and maybe we can talk about that for sure. Also, what happened to Patch and the consolidations and cutbacks there, although it's still around, but in a smaller form. We'll take more of your questions and comments, too. Thanks for that call, Steve. The number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, media trends and how they're playing out this election season. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. How do you think media coverage has been during this election cycle? And more broadly, what changes have you seen in the media landscape here in New Hampshire over the past decade or two? One more time, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. With me in studio, Meg Heckman, a lecturer teaching journalism at UNH, former reporter for the Concord Monitor and other publications. Meg's currently writing for the Boston Globe. Also with us, John Tabor, publisher and president of Seacoast Media Group, which publishes 5 weeklies and 2 dailies, the Portsmouth Herald and Foster's Daily Democrat. And Dan Kennedy joins us by phone, media critic and associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University. And Dan, just before the break, you were taking issue with John's statement that it's been hard for folks to find a way to make hyper-local journalism pay. I'd love your thoughts there, Dan.
Well, I mean, it's hard to make journalism pay at any level, but, it's a couple of years ago, I wrote a book about online hyperlocal journalism called The Wired City, and I think that most of it was about a online-only news site in New Haven called the New Haven Independent that's really kind of a model for what we can do at the hyperlocal level. They have been around for 10 years. They're doing very well. It's small. And it's nonprofit, so it's very much like public radio. They get their funding from donations, grants, and things like that. But the thing is, they have been able to provide extremely robust coverage at the local level. And last year, they actually expanded into low-power FM radio. So they've extended their community mission that way. I also tracked some for-profit online-only projects that are doing well, and I agree with John that it's very hard for them, but they're finding a way to make a go of it.
How do they make a go of it? Again, financially, and we all remember when, you know, Patch here in New Hampshire massively downsized.
Well, you know, I mean, as there's a group called the Local Independent Online Publishers, and their slogan is "Local doesn't scale." And Patch was anything but local, and there are a few patches here and there that do pretty well, including one in New Hampshire that I know of. But for the most part, you know, the idea of a top-down corporate approach to hyperlocal journalism was never going to be very successful. It really has to be at the grassroots. And the sites I've looked at, probably one of the more prominent ones is in a little town in western New York called Batavia, where a site called The Batavian is for-profit, surviving with local ads. There are something like 150 advertisers that you can see when you go there. It's everything from pizza shops and tattoo parlors to funeral homes and banks. And I know that the person who's running it is making a decent living at it.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at the changing media landscape nationally and especially here in New Hampshire and how that is affecting coverage of the New Hampshire primary. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And joining us from Manchester is Nancy. Hi, Nancy. You're on the Exchange. Welcome. Nancy, go ahead. You're on the air. All right. Hopefully, Nancy will call back. Again,
I'm
Nancy.
Here.
Nancy, go ahead. Yep.
Hi, Laura. Nancy West here. I started in-depthnh.org 5 months ago, and really, I can't believe how it's taking off. It's a nonprofit, investigative news site. But if you've got a phone right now, you can check us out. 40% of our readers go on to their phones to take a look. And we've just really done some fabulous, fabulous primary reporting. We've had John Harrigan. I think everybody knows John. And he did a wonderful column recently about his very first primary. And Nixon was in it. You know, we have such great experienced journalists.
And you're a nonprofit, Nancy.
Yes.
Kind of like public radio.
I'm sorry?
Kind of like public radio. You're a nonprofit.
Yes, actually, we fund the very same way. We go after grants, donations. We're about to launch our corporate donation program. And I think that's got to be the wave of the future. I think it's been well proven that the advertising model doesn't work.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. What do you think, Meg? And then I'll turn to you, John. Go ahead.
Again, I think this is just a great example of media innovation in a digital publishing framework. And I think a couple things that Nancy said were really interesting to me. One, the fact that she's getting so much mobile traffic. Mobile is huge and something that news producers and publishers at all levels, from startups like Nancy right up to international news organizations, are trying to figure out how to capitalize to better connect with their audience. And I also think it's interesting that Nancy and her staff are using the primary to engage in some storytelling that I'm sure is just fantastic journalism, but is also a way to become a part of that civic conversation. And I'd be interested to know how that will translate to civic coverage after the primary. Nancy, I don't know if you're still on the line, but does that seem – no, okay. If that seems like a launch pad to a more solid footing in the conversation that's going to happen once all the candidates have packed up and gone home.
Well, it gets back to your original point, Meg, that the New Hampshire primary has been a laboratory for media innovation. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. What are your thoughts, John?
Yeah, I wanted to just cheer Nancy on because I think that's a great project. And in Maine and in Connecticut, there are similar nonprofit sort of foundation model funded outlets, and they've really moved into the space that's been vacated by State House reporters that would cover Hartford or Augusta. And, you know, one person who really invests time in covering the State House can sort of look around the corners and find what's going on in the side rooms and have those in-depth conversations. And unfortunately, newspapers don't have those State House reporters anymore. But this online model has really stepped into that. And interestingly, the reaction of some of the newspapers and the press associations was, well, we can't let them in our awards contest. And others of us said, that's crazy. They're doing great work.
Well, there are so few State House reporters now. I've heard longtime State House reporters say it used to be crowded in that press room, and now they're just a couple folks rattling around. Meg.
Just to follow up on that, I know when I was president of the New Hampshire Press Association, that was one of the big conversations we were having was, do we allow digital-only publications? And the answer was a resounding and unanimous yes. And if I remember the conversation correctly, it was because we saw that as a way to raise the bar for everyone. In the best-case scenario, more voices and more serious practitioners of journalism will raise the bar and create, we hope, a news product that is more diverse and better informs the community.
And Dan Kennedy, your thoughts too on Nancy's point that you know, you can do hyper-local journalism in the nonprofit model.
That's right. And, you know, she said the advertising model doesn't work. It's harder. She's absolutely right about that. But I wouldn't say that even the advertising model doesn't work. It's just a more difficult slog. It's kind of easier to go out and raise money in large chunks, as nonprofits are able to do. And, you know, we've really seen this all over the place. John mentioned a nonprofit in Connecticut covering the State House. He's referring to the Connecticut Mirror. But the Connecticut Mirror actually competes with a for-profit State House news site called CT News Junkie. You know, I was the media columnist for the Boston Phoenix for many years, and I think that one of the very first columns I ever wrote in the mid-90s was Whatever Happened to Statehouse Reporters. The Statehouse Press Gallery was fairly empty in the mid-90s. I think that it's probably more crowded today. The last time I visited the Connecticut Statehouse, the space that CT News Junkie had taken was filling up because of all of the stringers they'd hired and additional people. It's really quite a and then you've got the Connecticut Mirror people as well. It's really, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about the growth of different types of digital media projects.
What's the quality of some of these projects, Dan? You know, there are a lot of journalism outfits these days that take a hard slant one way or the other. People posing as journalists, but they're actually have an agenda. So are some of those new faces and new arrivals what we would call fair and balanced journalists? And does it matter?
Certainly plenty of journalists have agendas, don't they? Some of the sites we're talking about here is absolutely top-flight, excellent journalism, as good as you would find in print or on public radio. We're talking about people who are really, really dedicated to doing a good job. I think that, you know, we started talking off talking about some of the national products that have sprung up. I actually think that with some of the national projects, that's where you're more likely to run into an agenda, because we're talking about political coverage. A lot of the new digital players in covering politics are coming at it from a liberal or a conservative point of view. And sometimes they are doing good journalism within those confines, but their audience has to understand where they're coming from in order to process what they are reading.
Let's take another call. This is Guy in Nashua. Hi, Guy. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Laura.
Sure.
And thank you to the guests you got this morning. This is a really relevant, to my mind, an extremely relevant point for media and its presentation of candidates' perspectives and views. And I want to really thank the previous guests you had on who were pointing out the fact that we've gotten to a point where, you know, as a worker, as a voter, and a person who's having to work one, two jobs, it's really more, I'm more dependent upon media to give me good information about candidates' perspectives and what their plan or solutions would be. We've kind of gotten to the point in my perspective, and I just want to ask this, you know, when you get to the point where you think your fact-checking is what's giving you relevance to making decisions about candidates, then to find out the fact-checking is not even correct, that creates a great deal of distress. I mean, Alexander Hamilton's comment way back at the beginning when the Constitution was being formed was, does the common man have the ability to make a knowledgeable decision about a candidate? And that, you know, that was one of his objections to the common man having a vote.
Wow.
Was that they would not be educated enough to make the right choices. I see too many people today making emotional choices, not choices based upon what the candidate really represents. And I'd like to get feedback from your guests on that.
Well, and what a great quote. And I appreciate on Election Day, especially, Guy, you going back to the founding and some of the early statements back then. What do you think, John Tabor?
Well, first off, it is a wonderful quote, and I think any of us in the media business really go to work today for that person, that average person who wants to know enough information to make a vote. And regardless of what media you're in, we all know that there's a loyal group of people who do want hard news, and they want they also want to read the opinion page, and they want to read the letters, and they want to really get all different points of view. I think that's harder in a 24-hour news cycle when cable channels need tons of commentary to fill the time. And as Dan points out, we get into horse racing and what the polls are saying. I mean, how many hours have people had to listen to what the polls say? And the polls right now, because they don't include cell phones, are horribly inaccurate. And so I think, you know, I'm very excited about what will happen today vis-a-vis all of that horse racing.
Well, I definitely want to ask all of you about polls and how they've been used with debates. And that's been a big issue for our listeners, too. Guy, thank you so much for the call. And just following up on Guy's call, here's Linda in Francistown, who says the mainstream media, including NPR, fills airtime with speculation. What do you think is going to happen versus actual reporting of what has happened? Linda says the Monadnock Ledger transcript does an impressive job twice a week reporting, capital letters in Linda's email, on the Monadnock region, including in-depth looks at news elsewhere that impacts us, e.g. FERC, Kinder Morgan, and the pipeline. Linda, thank you so much for that. So this is kind of the theme, Meg, that we keep returning to, people appreciating the local media for giving them, you know, the real stuff instead of continuing to just chatter away.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Ledger Transcript is a phenomenal local paper. Just really one of the best out there. And the email writer is absolutely correct. And I think that's one of the challenges that any managing editor in a local newsroom is facing this week and in the months before, because there are so many local stories that need to get told. I mean, we're coming up on town meeting season. I was having a conversation with an editor friend of mine who was trying to figure out how to cover deliberative sessions and school district meetings at the same time as Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz and everybody else was in the state. And it's a really difficult question. And it kind of gets back to what Dan was saying at the beginning of the show, where everybody is paying attention to the primary, but who's paying attention to whether or not the Board of Selectmen is releasing public documents? And those are really hard decisions that local editors have to make. And I'm sure John can add to this. It's probably harder now than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Because you just had more people on staff 10 or 15 years ago, Meg?
More people on staff and then fewer competitors to cover the primary. I mean, certainly the week between Iowa and New Hampshire, everybody has always been here. But like Dan was saying, it really feels this time around that everyone is trying to carve out an audience in the context of the primary. And a lot of news organizations feel they have no choice but to compete. And sometimes that might mean sacrificing local stories that nobody else is looking at.
Well, and Dan, since John mentioned it, let's talk a little bit more about the polls. We have received a lot of complaints from our listeners that, you know, the media focuses too much on polls and that focus has shut certain people out of debates or put them at the kids' table or whatever you want to call it, the undercard debates. What are your thoughts there on the dominance of polls and how they're used by media, Dan?
We've really seen polls taken to an extreme in this particular campaign. You know, John said that they're not even accurate because they don't include cell phones. I've heard pollsters say recently that they are starting to include cell phones. I just want to say I hope I don't get one of those calls on my cell phone. I haven't gotten one yet. But, you know, in fact, we have kind of a crisis in polling in that fewer and fewer people are willing to participate, which makes it harder and harder to know whether they're accurate or not. And yet, this campaign season has been so dominated by the debates. And as you said, polls are used to determine who's included, who isn't, where the candidates get to stand on stage. Informally, at least, it seems to drive a lot of how many minutes each candidate gets. This is a totally improper use of polling. It's been done at a time when, I mean, now people are paying attention. But months ago, very few people were even paying attention, and yet polls were used to make these really important decisions.
And national polls.
One thing.
Yeah, and Dan, I said national polls, not polls here in New Hampshire or Iowa or South Carolina. Dan, hold on to that thought. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at media trends and how they're playing out in this primary election season. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan Kennedy, go ahead. I had to cut you off there. You were talking about the importance of polls this year, how they're used to shape debates, who's on, who's not. And yet, at a time when you're questioning the accuracy and the validity of these polls. So go ahead, Dan.
Right. And, you know, I mean, even if the polls were 100% accurate, I certainly don't think that they should be used to determine who gets to participate and who doesn't months before anybody has cast a vote. I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but one thing I didn't understand back when the Republicans had 18 candidates, why didn't the cable stations just have, you know, draw lots at random and do a series of debates of six candidates each? We're talking about cable news here. They literally have nothing better to do. So why not?
They've got 24 hours to fill, right? Why not?
Exactly. Instead of just this constant dependence on polls that may or may not be accurate.
Question for you, Meg, about debates, and then we'll go back to our listeners. Are debates still an act of journalism, or have they become infotainment?
Both. And that's not a cheat of an answer. Here's why. I do think that a lot of the framing and messaging around the debates themselves really has kind of that Super Bowl feel to it. And that troubles me. I think that the political process should be a little more dignified than that, and maybe not gamified quite as much as the cable narrative tends
gamified.
To.
What do you mean by
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it feels like they're looking for a fight. They're looking to pit one person against another because it makes good TV. And I think really debates are valuable when they allow for some substantive discussions of policy. But I do think that what happens around the fringes of debates can be really interesting. Debates are big political events. And we saw this happen last Thursday night out at UNH when we had the Democratic debate come kind of last minute. It was very interesting. And it was happening quite literally across the street from our journalism lab. And so we kicked a bunch of our students out on debate night. And they found these really fascinating mini narratives about what was driving people to come out on debate night. So I think the debates themselves can tend a little bit more towards infotainment, but the reaction to those debates can really hold some interesting stories that can be telling about what's in the hearts and minds of voters.
Well, and one more question about polls for you, John, and then we'll go back to our listeners. So let's say there's a big new UNH poll, which is regarded as the gold standard here in the Granite State. Let's say there's a big UNH poll that shows, you know, who knows, candidate X pulling far ahead of candidate Y. Do you put that on the front page of the Portsmouth Herald and Foster's Daily Democrat?
We obviously have to cover it. I think our coverage focuses really on candidate appearances.
Your area.
What they say, and more important, what our readers say afterwards, because people recognize friends that they know in those comments.
So you're really dedicated to the local reverberations of these national events. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. And the polls, I think New Hampshire has proven the polls are often wildly wrong, because so much happens in the last 48 hours as voters make up their mind. There's a huge group of voters that are undecided, were undecided, and hundreds, you know, tens of thousands of them are out there right now making up their mind, or last night or the day before.
Let's go to some more of our listeners. And Sandra is waiting in Thornton. Hi, Sandra, you're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a couple of comments. And it's more about the media trends that I've noticed from the Thornton area, which is above Plymouth, New Hampshire.
Sure.
And I've noticed over the handful of years the lack of coverage in newspapers in my area. Now, to their credit, to the east of us is the Laconia Sun, which is delivered to a hospital that I work at free, and it's just about the only coverage we get. And out of Laconia, that Sun paper has both local for them and worldwide, articles. And I think they're doing a wonderful job. But so this is I'm really thankful that you're having this program, because it's been a concern of mine about what's happening with the media trends.
So there's sort of hot spots and cool spots, you're saying, in terms of local media, Sandra. Go ahead.
Yes, and there's a university in this town of Plymouth, et cetera. But we don't have coverage coming out of this area or a newspaper. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to voice this.
Well, and Sandra, good to hear from you. And I'll turn to you again, John. What do you think? There's hot spots and cold spots.
Yeah, and the Laconia Sun is a wonderful startup that is a free daily. It's delivered and stacked on cigarette machines or at waiting rooms or at coffee shops, the grocery store, and phenomenal success. And that's a great entrepreneurial story. Adam Hirshan and Ed Engler and Mark Garang started that. And it's really a great voice for that community.
Let's take another call. This is Chris in Nashua. Oh, Chris, I think we just lost you. You can call us back, Chris, if you want, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's a Facebook comment from Chris that came in. Again, we asked on Facebook, how do you think media coverage has been during this election cycle so far? Chris says it's gotten worse. Each cycle, the coverage gets longer and longer. This creates a disadvantage for less controversial and or figures with less monetary influence. Chris says Hillary Clinton was said to be the Democratic frontrunner back in 2012 after Obama got reelected. And Chris says even though Bernie Sanders managed to defy the odds, others like Democrat Martin O'Malley and Republicans George Pataki and Rand Paul had no chance. He concludes, I'm going to throw this to you, Dan. He concludes by saying, I feel if we adopted the European Canadian style of campaign restrictions where candidates can only campaign during a specified window like 8 weeks, then the media could be more fair and balanced to all candidates and issues. Chris, thank you so much for that Facebook comment. I've heard this from other people, Dan Kennedy, people saying, cut it off at 8 weeks or 6 weeks or something. What do you think?
Well, you have much shorter campaigns under a parliamentary system because a government falls and then there's a short campaign to elect a new parliament and it's over. We have set dates for elections in this country, and that results in the campaign cycle getting longer and longer. I think that it was a generation ago that Sidney Blumenthal, who is not just Hillary Clinton's Svengali, but is also a fine political journalist, labeled it the permanent campaign, and that's exactly what it is now.
And is that the media's fault?
It's the fault of the candidates who begin running for president almost as soon as the president's inaugurated. The next campaign begins, so you get some coverage of that. It's the fault of these fixed dates, as I say, and I suppose it's the fault of the media for starting to cover these things long before anybody really cares about it. But on the other hand, if you have candidates running around doing things, then the media do have a certain obligation to cover those things, maybe not as repetitiously as they do, but I don't think it can be ignored either.
I'd love to ask you, Dan, about a complaint and then a counter-complaint that we often hear. People say the media covers the horse race too much. They cover the polls too much. Or in other contexts, they say that, if it bleeds, it leads. The media covers salacious crime and so forth. And then some news people push back and they say, well, we wouldn't cover it if people didn't watch it / buy it, click it and so forth. So what do you think about that? That in one sense, the media is giving folks what they look at, read, tune to.
I think that horse race coverage is part of any well-balanced media diet. And, I enjoy some of it myself. The problem is, I think that any news organization that wants to be fulfilling its duties for public service has to give its audience a combination of what it wants and what it needs. And so in addition to doing the horse race, in addition to doing the polls, we really need to have some real substantive coverage of exactly what kind of a president these candidates would make. What we tend to see is that when the pace of the coverage is more leisurely, many months before people are really paying attention, that's when we tend to see the longer pieces on who these folks are, what kind of a president they would make. And then in the final months leading up before the primaries, that all disappears. People are finally paying attention. They don't realize that the more substantive stuff that they might have been interested in appeared months ago, and away we go.
So the media could say, look, we did it. We did their stance on, you know, taxes or whatever. But as folks are tuning into the race, Dan, you're saying that coverage isn't there. And they say, hey, why aren't you talking about the guy's stance on taxes?
Exactly. Now, one thing that the move to online has managed to do is that if you go to the politics page of a good newspaper online, you will tend to see their past coverage. And if they did some big pieces on the candidate some months earlier, it's still in front of you. So that's one way that I think that moving to online has benefited the audience.
You can look it up.
You don't even have to look it up. It's right there.
Yeah.
It wasn't thrown out with yesterday's fish 6 months ago.
You know, John, I'd love your thoughts on this, too. The complaints that, you know, some people have, you didn't cover this, you didn't cover this. Why do you only cover the sensational stuff of the horse race? On the other hand, if that's selling newspapers, that's kind of your job.
Yeah, and I think there's the what we'd all should aspire to in our business is the enterprise reporting that gets background on a candidate somehow. And I'm thinking more of the national media. You know, Sunday's New York Times had a story about Bernie Sanders as chair of the Senate Committee on the Veterans Administration and why he had not spoken out earlier about how broken it was. And he was at the time saying, you know, there's big money interests who want to cut government and want to cut funding, and I have to defend this. Well, you know, it's great to want government to do those things, but it's got to work. And I thought it was a the kind of enterprise reporting that really tells readers about a candidate. And that's the role of newspapers. They're sort of the spinal column that supports all the other media. And
can they still do that work, though, John, in an era of cutbacks? We hear so many reporters say, I used to be able to do those stories, and now I'm just, you know, flying around covering this news conference and that news conference.
That's a big challenge.
Because there used to be 10 reporters, and now there's only two.
That's a big challenge. But I think we all know that the audience is there that wants to read that.
And we saw that, for example, Meg in the movie Spotlight. We saw that team at the Boston Globe where you're now writing, and what it means to have a team of people whose bosses say, yes, take the time, do what it takes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that there are so many good people in legacy newsrooms working really hard and doing good work. And I know that they definitely feel torn between covering those quick hit spot news assignments and finding time to do the longer form, more thoughtful pieces. But again, we're starting to see an increasing number of innovative entrepreneurial outlets that are trying to do more of that work. And some of that is happening tied to the primary, and some of that is happening outside of political journalism. And I don't quite know where all of those news organizations are going to end up, but I do think that there are still a lot of journalists who care very much about it. It's going to be a matter of finding out how to balance all of that as we go forward.
Let's take one more call. And Larry is calling from Maine. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Okay, thank you. And as you indicated, I'm calling from West Baldwin, Maine. And I'll say that here in my years, I'm 85 years old now, and I've been a Republican and a Democrat registered on both sides in the past. And maybe I'm a slow learner, but it's come to pass that I am now an independent, adamant, ardent independent, and I've come to realize that I think that, for one thing, the media has been totally unfair in the whole process. It's become a show, a talk show situation where all forms of the media focus on those individuals that are the most flamboyant, and they catch the interest of the media control folks as well as the population, what they think the population would be interested in. And also, I think that both the Republican and Democratic parties have become a primary problem in the political sphere.
Well, and Larry, in the interest of time, I got to let you go, and I do apologize. Thank you for calling in. So, Dan Kennedy, too much in the way of infotainment and antics and just trying to grab eyeballs and clicks and headlines and to heck with quality.
I would agree with that, but, you know...
that's pretty harsh, Dan.
but you know, I would also say that a minute ago we were talking about the movie Spotlight, and even though the Boston Globe's newsroom is about half the size as it was when they were doing the reporting that is told in Spotlight, the Spotlight team is actually bigger than it was then. So there's a way of allocating resources to the things that really matter. And I think news organizations that really care about that, like the Boston Globe, have been finding a way to do it.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Larry. Final thoughts from Larry's call there, Meg Heckman. Feeling frustrated with the way things are covered and the emphasis that we see.
Yeah, I, like Dan said, I don't disagree with that. But I do think that there is hope, and I really hope that we see some of the high-quality journalistic innovation happening within the context of the primary continue for those more local stories after everybody goes home tomorrow.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much. And Dan Kennedy, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Kennedy, media critic and associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University, currently a Joan Shorenstein Center Fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School. And John Tabor, it was really good to have you here. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
John Tabor, publisher and president of Seacoast Media Group, which publishes 5 weeklies and 2 dailies, the Portsmouth Herald and Foster's Daily Democrat. And Meg Heckman, great to see you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Meg Heckman, a lecturer teaching journalism at UNH, former reporter for the Concord Monitor, currently writing for the Boston Globe. This is The Exchange on NHPR.